Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps.
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 Im Chul. Marunam Anne Strainchamps.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Anne Strainchamps.
Nella, Naki Anne Strainchamps.
Ja, I am Strainchamps.
Ani, Anne Strainchamps.
Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps.
Perfect.
Hold on. I'm Anne Strainchamps, right? This voice, right here, this is me. If you've heard the show before, maybe you recognize me. If not, I guess you'll just have to trust the person behind the microphone. As a radio host, my only identifying feature is my voice. This is how you know who I am. But what if you don't like it? Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, we're listening to and thinking about voices and all the ways we judge, criticize, repress, and police them. All the ways we censor the sound of our own voices. Take David Thorpe. He's the producer and director of a documentary that asks the question, do I sound gay? Spoiler alert, yes, he does. But one day, he started wondering why. He was going through a tough breakup at the time, and he had decided to go out to Fire Island for the weekend. But on his way there, well, wait, I'll just let him tell it.
I had kind of a lightning bolt experience after a breakup in which I was on a train to Fire Island, ostensibly to kind of get over the breakup. And I found myself really irked by the voices around me and sort of overcome with this realization that, you know, I had spent 25 years not comfortable with my voice and that I needed to figure out why and what to do about it.
But what does that even mean? To sound gay. I mean, you're talking about not just the things you talk about and not just, I don't know, specific speech patterns or actually literally the sound of your voice.
Some of the stereotypical traits of a gay voice would be a voice that's higher, softer, a voice that is both very precise in the way that it is spoken, but also possibly very languorous and drawing out the vowels. A lot of variation in pitch is also a typical tip-off for people. The hissy S, that sibilant sound, is truly the signature of a so-called gay voice. And those are the basic traits that people look or listen for.
Are you suggesting that those are all learned traits? Because you went back and asked, you know, your family members, old friends, you know, did I always sound gay or was there a moment when I changed? What did they tell you?
Yeah, for me, what happened was that as I was starting to go through puberty, I had a lot of like gender nonconforming ways of expressing myself. And I was pretty effeminate as a little boy. But as I got into middle school, I learned very quickly that that effeminacy was not acceptable. And I straightened myself out, so to speak, including my voice. But what my friends and family told me in the course of my making the film was that after I did come out around the age of 19, I did start to change the way I spoke. And I did adopt a more stereotypically gay way of speaking.
September of 1993, you sounded like a straight boy from an academic family in South Carolina. And by May, you were sounding pretty gay.
Interesting. Okay. I didn't know. This has happened to me incrementally.
You were consciously or unconsciously exaggerating it for a while as you were sort of coming to terms with your identity, etc., but for sure.
You know, I had been in the closet for so long. And it was important to me to let people know that I was gay I wanted them to know from a far distance that a gay guy was coming down the path. But I think then, you know, as I got a bit older, that flamboyant way of speaking started to feel like a trap and maybe a performance.
Well, what's interesting about what you're saying is the way voice and identity are so linked. So, you know, you talk about changing your voice around 19 when you're just beginning to, you know, adopt your new adult identity. And of course, your voice kind of echoes and reflects that. And then it sounds like you know, quite a bit later, you began to wonder about that identity, as we all do. You know, there's a point at which we all get to a place where we've been living inside this particular adult identity we've crafted and lived inside for a while. And often there's a time when it doesn't fit anymore. It's like a, you know, set of clothes that have gotten too small.
Absolutely. I mean, we go through a lot of ups and downs in our lives, and we go through a lot of changes. And, you know, sometimes our voices follow and sometimes they don't. And I, you know, the film depicts a time in my life when I was feeling very vulnerable and feeling a real lack of confidence. There's no shortage of people from other backgrounds who talk about how their voices play a role in their sense of self, whether it's a lesbian of color who is really keenly aware of how she code switches, to Southerners who sometimes feel like their accents make them sound uneducated. Many people are not always in sync with their voices in terms of how they want to be seen or heard.
Mm. So you actually wound up going to a couple of speech therapists to try to sound less gay. I mean, first of all, there are therapists who do that.
Well, you know, I initially wanted to try to learn how to sound less gay so that in situations where I felt vulnerable about being visibly or audibly gay, I would feel safer. And, you know, also maybe for some more shallow reasons, sort of I knew that a more masculine voice would make me more attractive to other gay men, which just tends to sort of be how it is out on the single scene.
Wait, because that's a fascinating point. So sounding gay makes you less attractive to other gay men?
Well, you know, the gay community in general, there is a value placed on masculinity, just like in mainstream culture at large. And, you know, you only have to flip through a gay magazine to see how masculine and macho most of the images are that are supposed to be, you know, kind of exciting.
Does this seem problematic at all to you, like a kind of internalized homophobia?
In one way, the emphasis on masculinity is problematic, because it's a stereotype that many of us don't fit and that, frankly, many straight men don't fit. On the other hand, you know, there's nothing wrong with a fetish as long as it doesn't interfere with kind of your ability to form relationships with people. But there is a kind of superficial worship of masculinity that can be stigmatizing.
Right. Well, I guess the question is, on the one hand, is there a kind of worship of masculinity? And on the other hand, is there a dislike or rejection of femininity?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, this fear of sounding gay is a fear of effeminacy, which is essentially springs from a kind of misogyny, that women are less than, they're second-class citizens, that why would you ever want to be more like a woman and less like a man? And, you know, the gay community is no different than mainstream society. It's sometimes a shock, I think, to people who aren't gay to find that out. But, you know, I think it actually sort of shows how we're, in many ways, all prey to the same cultural prejudices.
It's fascinating how much, once you start digging into the voice, how many of the ways we code voices you realize we've grown up with. One of my favorite, and for me most eye-opening sections of your film is the one in which you wind up talking about Disney villains and this kind of whole cultural history that they're coded as gay, which I had never noticed.
You know, when you see them all cut together, it's very unmistakable that this kind of aristocratic, effeminate, gay voice has been a mainstay of Disney for quite some time.
I thought perhaps you were entertaining someone up there in your coils.
You know what happens when someone upsets me.
Perhaps I can divine a solution to this thorny problem.
Oh, I shall practice my curtsy.
It is a little bit disturbing to think that stereotypical gay voice is so affixed to the notion of the villain.
So when you set out to figure out whether you sound gay, did you figure out how to sound straight? I mean, what is the sound of straightness?
Well, let's say I understand sounding straight much better, even though I myself am not always capable of turning on a dime and doing so. But I mean, again, sounding straight is shorthand for a masculine or even hyper-masculine voice. So a voice that's lower, a voice that goes down at the end, that makes authoritative statements as opposed to going up at the end. We have yet to kind of allow an effeminate voice be an authoritative voice.
It's really fascinating when you start talking about it, don't you think? You just start noticing the infinite vocal variety around us and the many things our voices can signify. That's just, it makes the world more interesting.
I agree. I mean, I think one of the things that the process of making Do I Sound Gay helped me do was to learn to kind of delight in the variety of people's voices and the richness of what they tell us or we think they can tell us.
David Thorpe is the producer and director of Do I Sound Gay? It's streaming now on Netflix and other platforms. David got to decide for himself how he wants to sound, but other people are not so lucky. Here's the actor Keith Powell describing a scene from a new web series he writes and stars in called Keith Broke His Leg.
In this particular episode, my agent calls me and tells me that she has a voiceover audition for me, and it's for Baller Cruises, which is an African-American cruise line, and the copy for it is so horribly racist and stereotypical. And comedy ensues.
Baby mama ragging on you for the fourth time this week. Your pop skipped town with all your casino winnings again. Ever think you need a vacation from it all? For this month only, Baller Cruises, the nation's first and only African-American...
Okay, he's playing that up for comedic effect. But it's actually a painful reality. Keith tells Raymond Tongakar that before and since his breakout role on 30 Rock, he has been forced to confront how Hollywood thinks black men are supposed to talk.
Before I got on 30 Rock, I would always do auditions, and somebody would go, "Ah, that was great, but can it be a little bit more urban?"
Wait, really? This actually yeah. happened to you?
Oh my God, this is a completely accurate story. I actually was just told that a week ago. The person who auditioned me was like, but I mean, this character is down. There's so much more down than what you're playing. And I was like, what does that mean? So it happens a lot for a lot of black actors, unfortunately.
Yeah, I feel like there should be some kind of study looking at the coded language that directors...
It's a lot of coded language, yeah. Which is ironic because I was born in West Philadelphia. Frankly, I'm from the streets, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I'm, you know, my mother was on welfare. I lived in not the best neighborhood. You know, I'm the guy that a lot of people say are like street guys. And, you know, I don't talk like that. And a lot of my friends don't talk like that who also come from humble beginnings.
So going into your first audition, did you anticipate this? Is that something you thought you would encounter?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, I wasn't expecting the level of coded language and how strongly an industry felt about continuing and perpetuating stereotypes that are ultimately dismissive and belittling of an entire culture that is wide and varied. And so I started, you know, kind of lashing out at the beginning of my auditions.
Well, I understand that early on you actually adopted a really interesting strategy to kind of avoid these awkward right. conversations.
Yeah, well, I just would literally like walk into audition rooms with a English accent and then do the script as if it were just me and then go back to the English accent when leaving, completely making them think that I was British. And then I never got the note of, can you make it a little bit more urban again? Huh. It just made my life easier.
Well, you know, and that gets to this question I have. I mean, voice and racial identity are so closely intertwined, right?
Yeah.
And I would imagine that for someone to say that you're talking or acting white, it kind of suggests that you're less authentically black, right?
Correct. I mean, that's exactly what happens. And it's kind of disgusting. I mean, it goes into identity. And it goes basically back into how you were raised and what perceptions you were raised with. I mean, it very much exposes your own personal biases that you didn't know that you had if you identify race and voice. I sound like a black man because I'm black, right? Like, voices don't have color. And if someone looks at me and goes, well, your voice and your body don't align, it makes me go, well, then what do you think I should have sounded like?
You know, I'm reminded of something that I think it was John McWhorter, the linguist, that said it. But he basically talked about how, you know, white students have the space and freedom to kind of explore different identities. You know, you never hear people say, call someone a white goth or a white stoner.
Right.
And yet,
right.
If someone of color does that, I mean, they're perceived as acting white, right?
It happens all the time in comedy, specifically, where identity is taken away from you. In comedy, you're not just the golfer, you're the black golfer. Or, you know, I've auditioned for parts where it's called black guy. Like, your entire identity is boiled down to your race, is a trope in comedy. And it doesn't happen for a lot of white comedians.
Well, going back to, you know, Keith broke his leg, I mean, how do you reconcile that? Because, I mean, you do talk about issues of race. Aren't you afraid that some people might just call it, you know, a black comedian's web series?
Oh, I'm completely horrified by it. Not because I don't want to identify as black. I actually love being a black man and I love identifying as black. It's just that's not all of who I am. And what is so specific about this series is it talks about race, but it also talks about the individual within race, that there is a human being under there who has other things. A lot of people have been coming up to me and say to me, I never believed how completely identifiable the show is. There are like little moments in the show that people identify with about their marriage, about their friends, about their work life, and they identify with it across all racial boundaries. And that's kind of the point of the show, is to humanize basically a proud, black, articulate, smart man.
Which sounds remarkable in like 2015, right?
It sounds remarkable, but it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about another episode from the series, most recent one, Mellow.
Yeah.
And, you know, it involves...
I'm the most proud of that.
Can you just briefly talk about what happens? Maybe just give like a short description?
Actually, this episode is based 100% on a true story. My wife in the episode throws a karaoke party in the backyard and the police get called and comedy ensues.
You the owner of this house?
I am. What's the problem?
We received a noise complaint about the music you're playing back there.
I will tell them to turn it down.
It's probably a better idea if you just turn it off.
Can I ask who reported me?
Sir, a few of your neighbors called us. This is a work night. Now, I know this might not mean much to you, but there are plenty of residents that need their sleep. So a little less partying and a little bit more humility would be greatly appreciated.
Adam.
Okay. I will tell them to turn it off. You can go.
Have a nice rest of your night, sir.
You know, the new racism, because we live in the age of Obama, is not to be racist. It's to use coded language. And it's happened to me, and it's happened to me by police officers. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a real story. It really happened.
Well, do you see your comedy as kind of pushing against that type of narrow thinking and or that biased thinking? I mean, do you see your comedy as serving some kind of social justice purpose?
Well, I'd like to think about it as the anti-stereotype, right? In comedy, a lot of people, you have to kind of boil people down to their essence in order for it to be identifiable quickly, and then you can make fun of it, right? That is a structure in comedy, and it's a natural thing. So it's not just specific to race. It is specific to the dumb hillbilly or the valley girl. What I'm hoping to do with Keith Broke His Leg is kind of take that and put it on its head. I like comedy that's a little slower. And when you take comedy that's a little slower, that you don't have to reduce somebody down to a joke, you can still get the laughs, but you start seeing a human being in there. And that's kind of how I feel like the Mellow episode goes.
So what do you say now when someone at an audition asks you to, you know, sound quote unquote more urban?
I just take the note and do it the way that I want to, that is authentic to me, and then let the chips fall where they may. That's the thing, you know, that's the thing that I've learned throughout this journey and throughout making this web series is how do you survive in an industry that needs you but doesn't want you? And the way that you survive is to be yourself and to speak your truth. And you certainly don't have to fight to have your truth be heard, because sometimes it won't be heard, but the best you can do is just speak it.
That's the actor Keith Powell talking with Raymond Tongakar. You can check out his web series, Keith Broke His Leg, at getbroken.com. After the break, I'm diving into the debate on vocal fry and the policing of women's voices. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. I've spent a lot of time feeling bad about my voice. It's kind of scratchy. It can sound gravelly or rough. And it didn't help that right about the time I started hosting this show, people all over the internet began complaining about women's voices.
America's young women are running out of oxygen. What else could explain why so many of them sound like this?
Something called vocal fry that is creeping into the speech patterns of young women.
I sound like a sexy baby.
Shoes.
Fashion.
Pulling my leg.
A bazillion years ago.
Law school.
Fetch. The only one.
Learn to fly.
Baby shopping.
It's called with vocal Anna. Fry, right? Oh, and it's the most annoying thing ever.
Kind of like that.
So I heard all this stuff and I thought, oh my God, that's what I have. I have vocal fry. I should get help.
My name is Brienne Ruel. I am a speech pathologist who specializes in voice and voice disorders.
I'm Seth Daly. I'm an associate professor of surgery in otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
And these guys put me through a bunch of tests.
You were lucky enough to have the scope that actually travels through the mouth. It peeks over the back of the tongue. It's a very long, rigid metal scope, and it shines light down onto the vocal folds. But to do that, you have to stick out your tongue and say the sound E. The most distorted sounding E you probably ever hear.
This was not the most fun thing I've ever done, but it let them check out my vocal folds. Imagine something kind of like the mouth of a sea urchin opening and closing.
Thankfully, in your case, your vocal folds looked gorgeous. There was pliability. There was no stiffness. The structures were moving like they should.
Seth and Brienne are medical professionals, and the main thing they wanted me to know about vocal fry is there's nothing inherently wrong with it. Nothing.
It is a voice variant. It's a variant of voice production. Everyone is capable of having vocal fry, and all of us have elements of it.
Fry, to be clear, is a normal production in the voice. It's not something abnormal. It's something even songbirds do in nature.
Wait. If vocal fry is normal, if even songbirds do it, then why is everybody complaining about it? And specifically, why is everybody complaining about women and vocal fry? Think of the voice as a musical instrument. People are always coming up with new ways to play it. And it turns out that some of the most linguistically innovative people on the planet are teenage girls and young women. But what's music to one person's ears is sandpaper to another's.
I feel like you're on, this is like pop culture psychology. It's like, okay, well, tell me why you feel the way you do about Sierra. Like,
this is Call Your Girlfriend, a podcast hosted by three young women. And in every episode, they call each other up and they talk just the way girlfriends do, about pop culture, politics, their personal lives. It's a really popular show. And yet its creator, Anne Friedman, says they are constantly getting criticized, not for what they say, but for how they talk.
a common theme is that we seem like really smart women. If only we said like not so often, they might be able to pay attention to what we're actually saying.
So there's a whole package of vocal patterns that go together and get criticized together. Upspeak, which is when you use a rising intonation at the end of a sentence, using filler words like, I mean, you know, and vocal fry. Women who host podcasts or produce radio and use any of these get hate mail. I know I do. Even though there are plenty of men on the radio doing the same thing.
You know, Ira Glass has spoken about this. He has vocal fry. Many acclaimed male broadcasters have vocal fry. You know, women and men are both using filler words. They both have vocal fry. They both use upspeak. But for some reason, we think it makes women less serious, or we think we hear it more often when women are speaking. I try to look at it like, hey, if someone were emailing me and saying, like, you know, Anne, your ideas seem really smart, but then I notice that you're parting your hair on the left and it's really just not as attractive as when you used to part it on the right, or I noticed your skirt was an inch shorter than it should have been, so I couldn't listen to your ideas, I would immediately just laugh it off as absolute ridiculous sexism.
Here's the thing I don't understand. Why doesn't anyone tell men they should learn to talk more like women?
Well, that's another interesting thing. You know, the linguist I talked to said women, when we use filler words like this, it's because we're truly in conversation. We use pauses and likes and words that are sort of hedging to allow people we're in dialogue with to have an opening.
All this criticism of women's speech began to seem just like an old story to me. So I called up the mother of women in public broadcasting, Susan Stamberg. When she became the host of All Things Considered in 1972, she was the first woman to anchor a national broadcast news program. Did she get hostile comments?
The comments that I got directly to me were, yay, yay, more, keep it up. But unbeknownst to me, and I only learned about it 11 years after the fact, Bill Siemering, who was the creator of All Things Considered, told me that in the beginning, he had quite a bit of criticism from station managers who said, a woman's voice is not authoritative, she is not believable, she will not speak with any conviction, people will not take her seriously.
Wow.
Now, he waited 11 years to tell me this because he knew if he told me, it would have thrown me in some way and affected my performance.
Even so, Susan went through a phase of trying to change her voice, too.
Because there were no role models, I was the first to do this, figured I had to sound like the men.
So I lowered my voice and I tried to sound as authoritative as possible.
And he, Bill Siemering, said to me, be yourself. It was like Mr. Rogers, you know, I like you just the way you are. And as a matter of fact, I could stop being a silly pseudo man. And it became, in a way, because I was the first, the voice of NPR. That is, we moved from this stentorian voice from the top of the mountain, which is what broadcasting was then, to much more conversational, much more natural sound.
So what do you think about the current round of criticism of mostly young women's voices, the criticism that there's too much vocal fry, too much uptalk, too many filler words, too many likes and you knows? Do you have any particular reaction to all that?
I can't stand it. Is that particular enough for you?
Neutral? Why?
I believe this is as much generational as anything else. To my ear, it's unlovely. It calls attention to itself. It's distracting and it gets in the way of the information of what the person is trying to say. As a matter of fact, when I do interviews and people I'm interviewing begin to speak that way, as politely as I can, I interrupt and say, I'm so sorry, but would you mind just imagine that your voice is a line and end it straight. Don't go up with it at the end. Because after a while, to hear that too much it becomes really unpleasant, at least to my ear and to the ears of many people.
You're kidding. You actually coach your guests? You tell them stop talking that way?
Horrifying. I think you're horrified.
Fundamentally, what we forget all the time is that speaking should be an act of joy.
So here's another woman in public radio. This is Veronica Rickert. She's a friend and a colleague, and she runs workshops for people like me. women who want to develop the full power and range of their voices.
Because it's an instrument. It's an instrument that lives inside our body, so it becomes very personal. And so a lot of the ways that we feel about ourselves, our self-worth, our self-perception, our intelligence, a lot of that gets packaged into the voice.
I guess what I decided is I am really tired of worrying about my voice. I'm tired of feeling bad about something so fundamental about who I am. So, yeah, I have vocal fry. My voice creaks. It cracks sometimes. I don't care. That's what I sound like. That's who I am. There's something in between you and me, the radio, or the computer, or whatever device you're listening to. And that's true for, well, maybe for most of the voices you hear. Your favorite singers, the actors on your favorite TV shows, and of course your favorite radio hosts. You hear all of them thanks to technology, specifically signal processing. And as media historian Jonathan Stern tells Craig Ely, signal processing shapes the sound of all vocal media, from your telephone calls to the music of T-Pain.
When most people think about media, they think about those two things, the performers, the actors in a movie, the musicians making the music, and then they think about themselves listening to it. Signal processing is all the stuff that happens to sound in between those things, and it usually happens to it while sound is either electricity or digital data inside of a computer.
What's the importance of us learning what's going on in there?
I can't emphasize this enough. Our media aesthetics have nothing to do with what people do in rooms when they're in front of each other. The way voices sound, the way musical instruments sound, what's considered realistic, none of that has anything to do with what we think of as good sound when we're listening to the radio or listening to music. My voice right now is running through a Neumann U87 microphone, which is an industry standard. And the thing about this industry standard is it has certain, according to the tastes of radio engineers, euphonic characteristics. In other words, it makes stuff sound better than it sounds without it. But there's this other thing, and that's compression. The compression I'm talking about right now was first used in radio in the 1930s. And what it does is it reduces the difference between the quietest part of the sound and the loudest part of the sound. Mm-hmm. Most mediatic voices that we think sound good, whether we're talking about telephones, mobile phones, radio, singing, and popular music, are highly compressed, so much so that if you heard a voice that wasn't compressed, you would say they did something wrong to it.
You mentioned in terms of compression that there are two different kinds of compression, right? One is this dynamic range limiting. What's the second kind?
Yeah, the second kind is data compression, which is basically making files smaller. The idea is the bandwidth is the most expensive thing, and this is something your listeners can check every month when they look at their mobile phone bills. And this has been true pretty much for the history of communications. So what Bell did is they got interested in, like, what is the minimum amount of sound people need in order to discern speech? Can we build filters so that we can send more phone calls down the same size line and still have it be intelligible at the other end?
What were sort of the nuts and bolts of how you get more voices in the same pipe?
Well, okay, so one of the things they tried to do is determine the frequency range in which speech occurs.
Mm-hmm.
What they figured out is the mid-range is really the important part of hearing. In other words, you can get rid of a lot of the highs and a lot of the lows. And so you can basically lop off the ends of the sound and people can still understand what's happening at the other end of the line.
I want to go back, though. I want to focus a little bit more kind of specifically on the voice and this relationship between, you know, what we might consider the actual physical experience of singing or listening and its recorded form. I mean, I've heard it said about Bing Crosby or Sinatra that their real genius was learning that the voice actually wasn't their instrument. Their instrument was the microphone.
Yeah.
And this sort of continues to this day with kind of stylized vocal technologies like autotune.
Yeah. There's a lot to say about autotune. So the first thing is pitch correction has been a holy grail of the music industry since at least the 1960s, and there are many different technologies that have been used for pitch correction. Of course, it's also used as an artistic effect. And this is one of the things that people get confused about autotune. There's Cher's Believe, which is one of the most famous uses, where somebody's basically playing her voice through a keyboard. So sad. That's very different from the main use of autotune in professional studios, which is more like touch-up in Photoshop. Mm-hmm. You're getting rid of red eye in your like cheap photo editing program.
Right. I mean, when autotune is done well, we're not supposed to hear it, right?
That's exactly right. But of course, the most famous autotune uses are the obvious and egregious ones. And today's modern Bing Crosby, I would say you could go to T-Pain. Who has, you know, sort of built his career on the use of autotune, except it's important to say that that's in a whole tradition of black soul singing, mm-hmm. where doing weird mechanical things to your voice has a long tradition. Also in funk, you think about Cernow's Devoid of Funk and the Old Parliament Funkadelic records. You know what you can do with your funk star child? You will never see me dance. And actually what Cher's doing, well, or Cher's producers are doing in Believe is drawing on that African-American tradition.
So let me ask you this, though, because this question of autotune, it seems to me occasionally fraught with issues of authenticity and issues of performance. Is this a problem?
Not for me. Look, I mean, these are aesthetic discussions, right? If you like old-time country music, you're not going to like the new Nashville. If you like new heavy metal, you're going to think Kiss is cheesy. Maybe. Maybe you won't. We often look for sort of technological justifications for our taste. And so people say, well, this autotune stuff, it's all so artificial. There's nothing more artificial than an authenticity-laced, like, old-timey country performance in a studio today where they bring in, like, a 50-year-old tape machine that's been rehabbed and reproduced, and they've sourced new old stock military tubes for the microphones. And then they've got these old instruments with like carefully maintained patina that they bought through collectors. Like it's just as artificial. The artifice is just in a different place. And so when I think about the voice, one of the things that's interesting about it is it carries this cultural freight of authenticity, of being an expression of a person's interior state, who they really are. At the same time, it is one of the most disciplined, trained, standardized, regulated dimensions of human life and expression.
You mean like in terms of dictation or people who take singing training? I mean, how do we regulate the voice culturally?
In all sorts of ways. So, you know, where is it okay to talk loudly? Where is it, under what circumstances is it okay to talk quietly? You know, think about all the talk about vocal fry, right, as a problem with women's voices on radio, which really very quickly turns into like a referendum on whether women should be allowed to speak in public, which is, of course, ridiculous, right? It's just another sort of case of sexism rearing its ugly head.
I guess I'm wondering, how do technologies of the voice challenge or reinforce what we think of as the politics of the voice? Is there a sort of politics of the voice?
There isn't one politics of the voice. There are many politics of the voice. The idea of having a voice, of course, goes all the way back to the Greeks, where the idea of democracy was a bunch of people in a physical space talking to one another. And our ideas of democracy are still very often tied to this. But it's a real problem. For one thing, sometimes people are forced to speak when they don't want to. Sometimes voice is not the source of agency. It can be the source of subjugation, right? You have a right mm-hmm. to remain silent. Mm-hmm. There's a reason you do. And it's interesting how few places in American life you still have that right. The second thing is to say that sonic differences are proxies for all sorts of other social differences that we are effectively managing out of public life. We're saying they should not be audible, when in fact, if they were audible, we might have a better sense of the sort of human variety that's all around us and ways to negotiate being different from one another, but still together and in some kind of collective.
Jonathan Stern is a professor in culture and technology at McGill University. His most recent book is called MP3, The Meaning of a Format. He talked with Craig Ely. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we've been talking about voices. And while, yes, humans are out there making a lot of noise, we are not the only creatures on the planet that vocalize. Birds, whales, frogs, toads, insects, they all make noise. But do they have a voice? And if so, what do their voices tell us about the natural world? Bernie Krause is a musician who has been recording environmental sounds all over the planet since the 1970s. He recently talked with Steve Paulson about what he's learned in his lifetime of listening.
Bernie, when I think of a voice, I think of something that humans have, maybe even something that is uniquely human, but you seem to hear different kinds of voices. What is a voice for you?
Well, actually, you make a really good point, because we're so human-centric that we think of everything that we see and hear in the world as being entirely from our perspective. But a voice to me is anything that's expressed from any kind of organism or habitat.
So you would say animals have voices. I mean, whether we're talking about, you know, hearing frogs or birds. But are you saying it goes past that? I mean, is wind a kind of voice too?
Oh, it sure is. And let me describe to you what you're talking about here, because what I've done is I've taken the notion of the soundscape, meaning all of the sound that reaches our ears from any source. Well, I've taken that idea and developed it out into a number of different major sources. One of the sources is natural sound that's non-biological, like wind in the trees or waves at the ocean shore, water in a stream, that kind of thing. And that's what I call a geophony. So it's sounds of the earth that are natural sounds. And the second of these components is the biophony. That's all the organisms that create sound in a collective way that comes from natural habitats. And the third is the anthropophony, human noise. Some of it is controlled, like music and theater, and most of it is random and chaotic and incoherent. It's what we call noise.
So when you're listening to these recordings, can you only hear all of these different sounds because of the fidelity of your recording equipment, or can your natural ear just pick up a lot of these sounds?
Well, I've learned to listen very carefully. I started off as a musician, so I had some ability to be able to hear things in a discriminating way. But when I began to work in this field, it really helped me learn to hear in ways that I'd never heard before. Music doesn't even come close to teaching you that kind of discrimination. And I have to say that one of the benefits of this work is that I had a terrible case of ADHD I've had since the time I was a kid, and I still do as an older adult. And the only thing, and I'm talking about forget medication, forget therapies, and forget all that other stuff, the only thing that really helps mitigate this problem is natural sound. And I listen to it all the time.
Really? That's fascinating. You mean, so that calms you down?
Yeah. And it has a real, I'm sure that this stuff, if we do a little bit of research on it, I'm sure that this stuff would have true medical benefits if people want to do a little work on it.
Well, you mention in your book a Japanese form of healing called Shinrin-yoku, which literally means taking in the forest atmosphere.
Exactly right.
Which I love. I guess in practice that means, you know, you go out in the forest and, you know, you hang out under the canopy.
Well, exactly. And there are a number of groups that still live very closely connected to the natural world, like the Bayaka in the Central African Republic, or the Kalali in Papua New Guinea, and others as well, who, when they come in contact with the Western cash economies, the stress levels on trying to produce are so high that they really take a toll on these groups. And so finally what they do is they go away. They go away for 3 months into the forest just to listen to the sounds. And they actually heal by bathing themselves in these soundscapes, these biophonies.
I know there is really an emerging science of this kind of soundscape that you're talking about, but I'm wondering also if there's been an issue of what to listen to. I mean, I know that, for instance, if we're trying to identify birds, often you just hear that one individual bird, and that's supposed to explain what the bird is, but I'm wondering if science is coming to a different understanding of how actually to listen.
That's also a really great question, because when I began, the methodology for recording in the natural world meant that we had to go out with a very large parabolic dish and record single birds one at a time, or single mammals one at a time, or a frog or an insect. And what I realized very early on was we weren't getting very good information from this kind of reductionist, abstract, or fragmented, incoherent way of looking at the world. And so I was interested in a more holistic way of listening to the world. And I began very early recording from a more holistic perspective, recording the whole soundscape in a given habitat.
So what do these sounds tell us about our environments that we can't know if we just rely on other senses? We would be missing something that we can only understand through these kinds of soundscapes.
The whole idea of soundscape ecology has evolved from the notion that all of the collective sounds in a given healthy habitat from all the organisms that make these sounds tell us a great deal about the health and stability of that habitat. And the reason that we know that is if we take a look at a graphic illustration of sound called a spectrogram, we can actually see the discrimination of sounds, because what the animals do is they evolve in these habitats so that they establish their own bandwidth or their own niche. And the birds have one niche, the insects have another, the frogs have another niche, the mammals have another niche. And it's like television channels or radio station channels. And they all stay out of each other's way. And it's much like instruments in an orchestra. Just imagine a musical composition and you'll get the idea.
There are also similar principles operating in the ocean. And you have this incredible example of seals and magnetic signals in the lower atmosphere, and how two different species of seals 12,000 miles apart actually have similar vocalizations. Can you explain this?
Well, what I'm demonstrating here is how animals get their voices. And in this particular case, I use the illustration of thunderstorms that occur at the equator. And these thunderstorms transmit the electrical energy of the thunderstorm through the magnetic field to both poles, the North and the South Pole. And at the South Pole, there's a seal called the Weddell seal that has somehow picked up the signals of these low-frequency radio transmissions and created its vocalization based on the electrical energy of these thunderstorms, which is transmitted as a radio frequency. And they pick up these electrical signals and created their voice. Now, what's really unusual is that the Weddell seal never comes in contact with the bearded seal, which is in Alaska, the North Slope of Alaska. And the bearded seal has almost exactly the same kind of voice.
There are real-world implications to this kind of work as well. I mean, I know you've done recordings in national parks, for instance, and there's an ongoing controversy about how much human-made sound should be allowed in the national parks. How is this playing out?
My sense is that the national parks, like every place else, have to be open to a lot of different kinds of people, and they're going to come into the parks in many different ways of conveyance. Some on Harleys, straight piping their way through the valleys of Yosemite, some in RVs, some in cars that are a little bit more quiet and peaceful. And we have to just decide ourselves as a culture whether or not we want this noise. You know, there was this guy by the name of James Watt, who was Secretary of the Interior in the early 80s. He said, noise is power. And the more noisy we are as Americans, the more powerful we appear to be to others.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it does come back to that question, though, of if humans are part of nature. I mean, certainly we are. I mean, we are another animal. But then if we are making our own imprint on it, including, you know, adding all of these human-made sounds, is that maybe that's just the natural course of things?
I don't know. I'm not a good prognosticator in that sense. I don't know what the natural course of things is. I just know that we're part of it, and that if we destroy what it is that's around us, that's the very basis of our lives, there are going to be consequences for that. These biophonies are really critical for us to hear and preserve. This may be our very last chance to hear the voice of the divine.
Wow. Yeah. So one final question. What can we do to protect these natural soundscapes?
We can shut the hell up. And that's what we got to do.
Wow. I kind of hate to say anything after that. Bernie Kraus is a world-renowned soundscape ecologist and the author of Voices of the Wild. He talked with Steve Paulson. That's it for our show today. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Craig Ely produced today's show, with help from Raymond Tungekar, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Thanks also to Margot and Liam Dargan, Dan Fallon, Norman Gilliland, Jane Jamali, Bill Martins, Maureen McCollum, Susanna Michaels, Kirill Owen, Parth Shah, Judith Sears-Poisson, Marika Suval, and Christy Taylor. They all lent us their voices at the top of the show. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks to you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.